Hi, everyone. This is Alicia Halliday, and this is the Autism Science Foundation Weekly Science Podcast. This week, you're listening to a very special edition. It's the summary of 2018 research and what it means for families with autism, and it couldn't have happened without the Scientific Advisory Board of the Autism Science Foundation and Cheryl Cohen from the Interactive Autism Network. So thank all of you. The title of this year's summary is called A Spectrum Within a Spectrum, and hopefully in the next few minutes, you'll understand why. Researchers have known for some time that individuals with autism spectrum disorder, ASD, and their family members showed increased rates of psychiatric conditions, including things like anxiety, depression, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. A staggering one-third of children with autism also have one or more of those disorders. This year's research has given the community a deeper understanding of the biological connections between these conditions, the shared genetics, and why autism may be part of a larger spectrum of psychiatric issues affecting children and adults. Until recent changes in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, or DSM, a person could not receive a diagnosis of both ASD and ADHD, so the clinician normally chose one or the other depending on the prevailing symptoms. Researchers only focused on the presence of ADHD or ASD in families rather than the crossover. But because of the changes in the DSM, they're more able to do so now. So recently, researchers looked at first-degree relatives, meaning parents, siblings, and children, and they found a higher rate of autism among those with ADHD and ASD, as well as bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. By focusing on those with co-occurring diagnoses or an enriched family history, scientists see distinct cognitive profiles and behavioral features. This further means that there may be little subgroups of people with autism. A recent study that looked at all the previous studies of anxiety that occurred alongside of autism showed that adults with autism were 20 times more likely to have anxiety and much more likely to have obsessive-compulsive disorder than people without autism. Evidence from young children suggests that there's great overlap in the early predictors of anxiety and autism, which may diverge as children get older, forming two separate disorders. Another study showed that co-occurring psychiatric disorders like depression and anxiety may also be related to gastrointestinal issues experienced in people with autism. This research provides further evidence that people with autism and their family members need thorough evaluations for mental health issues. Unfortunately, people with autism have a higher rate of unmet mental health needs than other groups. The results of several studies this year identified factors such as the availability of family-centered care and out-of-pocket copays, which may affect access to the help that people need. These are two actionable items that advocacy organizations can focus on. Now, anecdotally, the Autism Science Foundation often hears from family members of those with autism wondering if a family history of a multitude of psychiatric issues had anything to do with their autism diagnosis. The answer now is probably closer to a yes than it was before, but that does not mean that anyone should ever feel guilty if they have a psychiatric illness about anybody else's problems. Based on these numbers, it's not surprising that several psychiatric issues, including autism, all share common underlying genetic mechanisms. First, looking at the genetic profile of brain tissue obtained from the cortex of individuals affected by either autism, schizophrenia, bipolar depression, or major depressive disorder, scientists revealed overlap in genetic expression. Now, mostly the overlap was between autism, schizophrenia, and bipolar. While there are overlapping genetics, the brains of people with schizophrenia do have a distinct lipid profile compared to autism. This suggests that schizophrenia, unlike autism, looks more like accelerated aging in the brain. Also, critical research from the brains of people with autism compared to schizophrenia and bipolar show that while genes are expressed similarly, the tiniest differences lead to different outcomes. Those with schizophrenia and bipolar depression express different isoforms, or the end products of gene expression, which markedly change what proteins are made. And those proteins may affect if the diagnosis is autism, schizophrenia, or bipolar disorder. Turning to analyses of gene function across these overlapping genes, these three disorders also show similar impact of synaptic genes and those affecting the central nervous immune system. Another landmark study this year included genetic information for over 1 million people worldwide, including those with 17 different psychiatric disorders like autism, schizophrenia, ADHD, versus neurological disorders like Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease. Now, the psychiatric diseases were more similar to each other in genetic profiles than they were to neurological disorders. And while autism showed distinct genetic features, it also overlapped with schizophrenia. The sample used, though, mostly included those with high intellectual ability and high college attainment, so it's possible that there were some other relationships not observed because you're looking at a particular subgroup of those with ASD. Also of interest, autism, ADHD, and schizophrenia are psychiatric issues with the highest genetic influence, with similar trends in heritability across the three disorders. The differences across studies and heritability estimates are likely because all three of these conditions have a variety of genetic environmental factors involved, and the diversity of genetic factors themselves is quite varied. While autism can be considered an umbrella, it's more likely than ever that schizophrenia, ADHD, bipolar disorder, and anxiety are a larger umbrella over this autism umbrella. Scientists note that misdiagnoses occurs frequently between these disorders, so some genetic overlap is probably not surprising. Given these findings, it seems important to include these other disorders when researching autism to identify commonalities and differences to exploit any therapeutic successes one disorder has had. That does not mean that what works in one group, like autism, is always going to work in another group, like schizophrenia, but it can begin an important scientific conversation. Differences within the autism spectrum are also seen in syndromes with a high prevalence of autism. For example, people with Phelan-McDermid syndrome, or PMS, have autism about 70% of the time. About 75% of people with something called Fragile X syndrome also have autism. Given this overlap, researchers have started to find out which interventions work for different forms of autism with and without known genetic causes. This is because people with a syndromic form of autism are more similar to each other than those without an established genetic link. So they're starting from a place where there are fewer behavioral differences. That can provide answers maybe even faster than if scientists only study those with no single genetic cause. So a new collaboration across these different rare genetic groups called AGENDA was formed this year. AGENDA is made up by about a half a dozen patient advocacy groups who represent these single gene forms of autism. They share solutions to common problems experienced in research and also by families. Now, one example of scientific evidence about why these different rare genetic disorders overlap comes from brain tissue research. Research who study the brains of people with autism examined a protein called FMRP. Now, this protein is missing in people with Fragile X syndrome, but they didn't really know before if this was common across all forms of autism. So they looked at this protein in those with a different genetic form of autism called Dup15q syndrome, as well as those with idiopathic autism. Idiopathic autism is a term for those with no single genetic cause of autism. The researchers found similarities in the expression of FMRP in the same areas of the brain with those with Dup15q syndrome who have mutations of chromosome 15, and also in idiopathic autism. This could mean that targeting FMRP is a viable therapeutic option for all forms of autism, regardless of genetic makeup. These findings would not be possible without the Autism Brain Net, a resource that supports the collection and analysis of brains of people with autism. To learn more about Autism Brain Net, and to importantly to register to receive information every few months on the progress of research thanks to studying brain tissue, go to www.takesbrains.org/signup. The question of how many people have an autism diagnosis seems to have a different answer depending on when, where, and how you ask. Now, this year was no different. Global prevalence numbers across the world continue to be collected and analyzed, and they're influenced by things like culture, stigma, and the availability of diagnostic measures. This year within the U.S., epidemiologists again saw two different prevalence numbers, which isn't surprising. The first, 1 in 59, was collected by the Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network, or ADAM, which examines education records and records of those who had received a formal diagnosis. It matches prevalence numbers from 2016. It's still not known whether or not this is the upper ceiling of prevalence, if it's going to stay at 1 in 59 or not. That's yet to be seen, but it was the same as 2 years ago. The other number came from an online or mail survey, previously a telephone survey, which asked parents whether or not they had a child with an autism diagnosis. Now, in November, that number was reported as 1 in 40. Why is there a difference? Probably part of it is the way that parents were asked, whether or not they had a child with a diagnosis or whether or not they had medical records. A prevalence study of autism diagnosis across time from Denmark might actually help reconcile these differences in numbers. As it turns out, prevalence in autism rose in Denmark with age as there are additional opportunities through school to be identified. In that study, the prevalence of autism was the highest so far. It was 1 in 35 in 16-year-olds born in 2000 to 2001, suggesting for the first time that prevalence may change with age. Additional data from the U.S. suggests that a small group of individuals who miss the diagnostic cutoff at age 3 might meet it at age 5. There are some kids who teeter on a diagnosis for years. Now, whether or not 1 in 59 or 1 in 40 is closer to the true prevalence of autism remains to be seen. For further report, that MMWR report of 1 in 59 further illustrates racial and ethnic disparity in access to diagnoses seen in the United States. So more work in better identifying people with autism at different ages and from different backgrounds so nobody is missed is sorely needed. There is also a huge disparity in diagnosis between males and females. And while the exact ratio of 4-to-1 males to females diagnosed with autism has been questioned, there is a real and consistent difference in the number of men versus women diagnosed. Researchers are searching for the causes of these differences and how they change over time. For example, young females with autism show better attention to social scenes, which may reduce autism severity and lead to fewer diagnoses in girls. In addition, as children, the special and restricted interests of girls are different from boys' interests. That is, their preferences are similar to neurotypical girls. These differences may lead to some girls with autism potentially being missed. In a subset of females with autism, specifically those that have higher intellectual abilities, some show more typical brain responses compared to males, suggesting that they may be able to mask their symptoms. However, researchers cannot rule out a biological underpinning of sex bias. Sex hormones, like androgens, at critical times in development, can influence the function of brain circuits associated with autism. A sex bias as a result of hormone exposure or alteration in sex hormones is possible. During key points in brain cell development, these hormones can cause cells to divide too quickly and affects disruptions in how cells turn into brain cells or other types of cells in the body, which are features of autism. Unfortunately, many studies looking at environmental factors that lead to autism in males versus females have not shown a difference across sex or not even looked at sex in the child. This prevents researchers from determining whether or not these environmental factors result in a sex bias. The presence of the core symptoms of autism seem to be similar for both males and females, though they may differ by severity or age. For example, in a large study conducted in the UK, males started out with higher autistic social traits, but as adolescence approached, that was no longer the case. Features of autism in males and females may change over time, get more or less severe depending on their sex. If the core symptoms of autism are present in females, why are fewer females diagnosed? This continues to be an important area of research. We do know that females do not escape the conditions that occur alongside autism. Previous research showed a higher level of internalizing behavior in females with autism. Internalizing behaviors are those that are inwardly expressed, like depression and anxiety. Externalizing or outwardly faced behaviors include acting out like aggression and impulsivity. This year, scientists examined another outward symptom, hoarding. Children with autism are 5 times more likely to show hoarding behavior. This is similar to the hoarding rates in ADHD and OCD, which is considered the core psychiatric illness associated with hoarding. Of really high importance, girls show more hoarding behavior than boys do. Since environmental factors were just mentioned with regards to sex differences, it should be noted that while environmental factors may not account for the sex bias in autism, they continue to be investigated and reported as an influence in ASD diagnosis. For example, there continues to be mounting evidence that air toxins, including air pollution, produces an increased probability of having a child with autism. Since the type and source of air pollution varies by country and region, it's not surprising that there may be some variability in the findings. Some studies show it's an effect of one chemical in air pollution. Another show it's a different component of air pollution. Now, air pollution as a whole should be a high concern across the world, and research should continue to build scientific evidence of its harmful effects, not just in autism, but in many developmental disorders. It's now more critical than ever to strengthen legislation around cleaner air. A chemical which scientists thought was no longer a problem because it had been banned 20 years ago was recently associated with autism. The effect was not huge, but it should serve as a reminder that known toxicants don't always disappear when legislation changes or manufacturing processes evolve. That doesn't mean we shouldn't push for legislation. It's just a reality. Other maternal health factors have been shown to later influence autism diagnosis. These things in moms from polycystic ovarian syndrome to a history of immune issues and even opiate use before conception. Though it's important to find factors that may contribute to autism, it's also very important to identify factors that don't contribute to autism. This year, researchers in Scandinavia were able to dispel the theory that autism is caused by too many antibiotics given because of too frequent ear infections. While scientists continue to make significant progress in understanding the roles of genetics and in genetic influence in autism risk, they're unable to better illustrate the mechanisms by which genes and the environment interact. However, new ways to study the environment and autism have emerged. Researchers were able to show the feasibility of using baby teeth to study environmental exposures during pregnancy. Baby teeth may be the easiest way to look at prenatal exposures because most moms collect them anyway and don't know what to do with them. Because the layers of the teeth form like rings on a tree during gestation, each layer can be analyzed to precisely examine month-to-month environmental exposure or even change in metabolism. This year, researchers who examined baby teeth of those with a later autism diagnosis found that the normal cycles of zinc and copper, which occur as part of normal biological processes, were altered in autism. This may reflect an inability to detoxify the body following exposure, but that theory needs further study. Also in 2018, researchers used brain tissue to show that genes relating to mitochondrial function were altered in those with autism. This is a new finding. And the changes correlated to genes which affect how brain cells or neurons are shaped and how they function. How neurons are shaped and how they function is pretty much the most replicated finding in autism besides sex differences that I know of. These findings suggest that mitochondria, which could be the targets of environmental factors, may act by altering the function of autism-related genes. Now, more on genetics. In the past decade, researchers have added greatly to the understanding of autism genetics, and many of these discoveries are actionable. Because whole genome sequencing technologies have become more accessible and more available to research labs, new types of genetic contributions are being discovered. In the past, geneticists were focusing on areas of the genome which code for proteins, as these are the areas that were thought to have the most influential effect on brain development. But in late 2018, thanks to newer genetic technologies like whole genome sequencing, new parts of the genome were able to be studied in relation to autism. They include regions of the DNA which serve as traffic lights, either stopping or starting the reading of genes from the genome. They are called promoter regions. And I'll mention other areas of the DNA were discovered to be associated with autism a little later. Past research has demonstrated that more genetic analyses can identify mutations that are targets of therapy, and a new emphasis on variations outside the protein coding genome could lead to even newer therapies. It's likely that there will be an increase in the discovery of rare genetic mutations that strongly influence an autism diagnosis. Now, one of these mutations is called a de novo mutation. They're not seen in either parent, but they are seen in the diagnosed individual. These gene changes sometimes overlap with autism, intellectual disability, and those that are involved in brain function. Now, right now, there are about 24 rare de novo gene mutations accounting for about 10% of the cases with autism. With more information on whole genome sequencing, this percent is likely to increase. But what about the rest of autism? Is it caused by de novo mutations that occur spontaneously? Well, there is another type of mutation called common variation. The theory behind common variation is that autism symptoms are a spectrum, and to some degree, everyone may fall on some part of that spectrum of autistic traits. The traits may correspond to specific genetic signals. In most cases, autism develops from the right combination of, or too many, common variants, including known autism risk genes and those that aren't known autism risk genes. Things that make us different as people could turn into symptoms of a disorder. As mentioned earlier, scientists now believe autism sits on the spectrum with other psychological issues, and therefore the genes associated with different psychological traits in the parents can combine to increase the chances that a person will receive an autism diagnosis. Now, some of these are inherited, some may be de novo, but they're not inherited as autism genes, they're inherited as common variations across the genome. More evidence comes from the understanding of the broader autism phenotype in families. Instead of looking at individuals with autism and their siblings, researchers explored genetic markers in all family members, including parents with the broader autism phenotype, and found some overlap in some of the genetic markers. That means even within families with lots of differences in the clinical presentation of symptoms, there are some overlapping genetic factors. These are probably common variants and not de novo. Now back to new genetic findings. As explained earlier, new areas of the genome are able to be studied thanks to new genetic technologies. Two different research groups discovered this year that other areas, called non-coding regions, harbor variants that confer risk for autism. Those promoter regions discussed earlier, they're also non-coding regions. But these studies looked at expression in family members. Using this design, geneticists calculated that the origin, well, not the mutation, but the origin of the mutation, came from the father's side, and a model of combined influence of paternal and maternal factors to generate these seemingly new or de novo mutations emerged. It should be noted, however, that these findings should be viewed with caution because there's a lot of different places on the entire genome, and scientists may need to adjust their statistical analysis techniques to make sure their findings are not by chance. In other words, stay tuned. What geneticists continue to be excited about is the discovery of new genes that are targets of existing therapeutics and can explain co-occurring medical or psychiatric symptoms. A better understanding of these targets is needed, which is why animal models are so important. Now, once scientists identify a target in the brain of someone with autism, it may take years of effort, money, and patience for that discovery to turn into something that can help people. A lot of times it takes 20 years. This is a difficult wait, but it can pay off. This year, a new drug received fast-track approval to treat the core symptoms of autism, balovaptan. It targets the vasopressin receptor. It's been shown to positively influence social interaction and social communication in adults. But the road to balovaptan had to start with animal models, not just see if it works, but also explore what dose and what behaviors were most promising to target in people. These models are becoming more sophisticated, more specific, and with each model comes a better approximation of autism symptoms. For example, researchers are using rats to examine social communication deficits that better approximate conversation. To be clear, autism is specifically human, but new therapies are becoming closer to real possibilities with the help of these models, for not just what works, but what does not. For example, environmental enrichment, which is a rough approximation in an animal model of behavioral intervention in rodents, has been shown to be beneficial in some models of autism, but not so in genetic models like SHANK3 knockouts. Parents of children who did not benefit from behavioral intervention see this as a possible explanation for why they haven't seen progress. However, it doesn't mean that early behavioral intervention is not effective, but that behavioral intervention may not work as well for a variety of reasons, including genetics. These models have identified existing drugs to target autism-related behaviors in what these SHANK models of autism. The animal models can help researchers identify similarities and differences on a cellular level between neurodevelopmental disorders, including ADHD and autism. They can help narrow down the mechanisms of sex differences, and they can also better understand the contributions of individual genes to autism as part of a larger group of genetic mutations, which is the case with most people with autism, as I just mentioned. Another important model for autism is the use of cells obtained from people. Researchers able to take skin cells from autistic individuals, turn them into embryonic-like cells called induced pluripotent stem cells, and then turn them into brain cells or any other type of cell they want. Is this not totally amazing? Scientists can use skin cells and turn them into brain cells and then study the function of those cells in a dish. Induced pluripotent stem cells obtained from humans can also offer results fairly quickly, allowing scientific advances to emerge more rapidly than obtaining brain tissue. It can also allow for multiple sets of questions to be answered at once by introducing new genes, new environmental factors, or both into the mix. The process does not replace the importance of studying cells directly from the brains of people with autism. However, there's just not enough brain tissue to use, so scientists are exploring other options. In fact, researchers use a combination of brain tissue analysis and neural stem cells to identify specific molecules in brain development in those with autism and the function of those molecules by inserting them into neural stem cells. It's validated the role of some molecules in both brain development and autism. And the continued production of cells in the brain, including those that share information and those that have more supportive roles. Using cells as a model for autism has a huge potential for better understanding the basic biology of autism, which will lead to better individualized interventions. Can you imagine taking the cells of someone with autism and then being able to determine what therapies they should receive? Scientists are also spending more and more time identifying endophenotypes of autism to better understand autism subgroups. Endophenotypes are groups of biological markers that might better serve in diagnosis, but in themselves are not autism. They're usually tied to genetics. These markers are incredibly important in understanding the development of autism and serving as objective markers for treatment protocols. Some examples include brain activity, brain structure, or nonspecific behaviors like language delay. This year, researchers explored some of these endophenotypes not as a single biomarker, but things that could be added together to create a profile of a probability of a diagnosis. The Baby Siblings Research Consortium, a group that tracks infants from high-risk families through diagnosis and adolescence, has made great advances this year. For example, early language abilities, especially understanding language, has emerged as a strong endophenotype. In fact, persistent language delay predicted autism outcome in an independent group of kids, reinforcing its use as an intermediate phenotype. In addition, changes in brainwave patterns, even as early as 3 months of age, years before a diagnosis, were shown to be a strong predictor, and even abnormal brainwave patterns without full-blown seizure activity is common in those with autism. Measuring brainwave patterns through a technique called electroencephalography, or EEG, is viable in a number of different common clinical situations, and it might be used in larger scale studies besides those with a high genetic risk for autism. In addition to studying brain function, features of brain structure were also identified as endophenotypes. Multiple replications in different samples showed a significant increase in extraaxial fluid around the brains of children with autism. This is the fluid that sits around the brain that almost acts like a cushion. This could be a marker of a biologically distinct subtype of autism. Researchers continue to study endophenotypes as markers of change, improvement, or prediction. While progress is being made in the biological features of autism, which can stratify different subgroups or measure biological differences across time through treatment to measure change, some of these are not yet ready for use in clinical settings. Unfortunately, the behavioral measures that scientists have used so far to measure treatment response were either developed for people without autism or those that were not intended to look at differences across time. Researchers have been working for years on developing measures which are based on clinician observation to document progress and detect these improvements. This year, the BOSC, or Brief Observation of Social Communication Change, was validated, and it's now being used in ongoing research studies. It's also important to note that this year, interventions were delivered in a wider choice of settings. Preliminary results showed that early intense behavioral intervention, which is based on the principles of ABA, improved cognitive functioning and allowed for less restrictive school placements. ABA, or applied behavioral analysis, should be considered more of a set of guiding principles delivered by trained clinicians rather than one specific practice. Importantly, the interventions were delivered by trained community providers, and the community is where most kids and autistic adults receive help. Moving some of these interventions into the schools can be challenging, but progress was made this year. At the risk of sounding like a broken record, teachers are overworked, they're underpaid, they're sometimes unappreciated, but in most cases, they want to do what's best for their students. There can be wide variability in how teachers implement what they have learned during training into a chaotic classroom with students of varying needs. Despite this, teachers have taken on interventions that focus on things like transitions in elementary classrooms with some success. This has required developing outcomes not just based on child outcome, but teacher behaviors as well. Going forward, not only is there a need for new measures, but also partnerships from clinic to real-world practice. Autism originates in childhood, and researchers have so far spent a lot of their time understanding autism in childhood. There's still much to be learned, including predicting adult outcomes based on features of autism in childhood, better understanding of the early signs and symptoms for better understanding autism across the lifespan, and the role of early intervention on long-term trajectories, and how these biological markers can help better in diagnosis and understanding of symptoms. We always say that there's not enough research on autistic adults, but autistic babies do become autistic adults. An increasing number of researchers, though, are focusing their effort on factors that affect the quality of life of individuals at all ages. This year, the International Society for Autism Research provided support for the development of a policy brief on employment in people with autism, and some of the early results support the need for a strengths-based approach to employing people on the spectrum. They noted that most of the literature has used approaches to manage symptoms in the workplace or help individuals with autism reduce problem behaviors. An alternative approach would be to identify the strengths and use those strengths productively. In addition, based on feedback from families and individuals on the spectrum, researchers are using employment to measure a good outcome from interventions, including cognitive behavioral therapy and other therapies. Scientists are also starting to understand a taboo subject in autism that typically occurs in adolescence to early adulthood, and that's suicide. A recent review revealed that most of the research on suicide and autism has been conducted in the last 5 years. In one study, numbers of those with autism were too low to come to a conclusion, but those with social communication deficits showed a higher rate of suicidal ideation compared to those without these deficits. On the other hand, other studies have shown that those with autism have up to a 66% rate of suicidal ideation and a 30% rate of suicide attempt. Unfortunately, there are no good diagnostic tools to detect suicidal thoughts in those with autism. Specific to the autism community, unmet care needs rose in important risk factors for suicidal ideation. Data gathered about people who are hospitalized for psychiatric problems, like psychiatric inpatient, show that depression and anxiety are important risk factors for suicidal ideation, and those conditions could be treated in this population. Psychiatric inpatients have as high of a 10% rate of autism, and because of their unique features, those with severe behaviors are least likely to be researched. Those with more severe behaviors tend to be underrepresented in autism research, and their needs are likely misunderstood. Their needs may often be ignored, but thanks to the Autism Inpatient Collection, a research study which includes many of the larger autism inpatient populations, this is changing. By studying autism inpatients, researchers have the opportunity to examine issues relating to those whose minimal language, intellectual disability, and self-injury requires hospitalization. Now, not surprisingly, rates of documented self-injurious behaviors are higher in a hospital setting than they are in a community setting, because that's why patients are there. In the AIC, those who exhibited self-injury at home and in the hospital had a lower IQ and more severe repetitive behavior scores, but no differences in autism severity. On the other hand, behaviors like irritability and hyperactivity are associated with shorter sleep in hospital settings. The lack of connection between autism severity, sleep, and self-injury suggests that self-injury and shorter sleep duration may represent a different dimension of autism rather than a feature of autism itself. One of the hottest topics this year has been the approval of a cannabis drug to treat seizures in people with a rare genetic mutation called Dravet syndrome. The drug, called Epidiolex, is a high concentration of cannabidiol, or CBD, and was shown effective in clinical trials, and its approval also opened the doors to demonstrate the efficacy of treating seizures of people with a multitude of syndromes besides Dravet. Cannabidiol, the main ingredient in Epidiolex, is obtained from the marijuana plant, but contains no THC or hallucinogenic cannabinoids. Nevertheless, the approval of this drug, together with marijuana legislation in several states, has elevated the discussion on the use of medical marijuana in the treatment of autism. While the effects of CBD for treatment of seizures is more established, Scientists are currently studying the effectiveness of the cannabis plant or other cannabis extracts in treating core symptoms of autism. In addition to cannabis, in 2018, researchers explored additional pharmaceutical treatments. They include drugs that were previously used to treat other conditions. For example, bumetanide, a drug to use to treat kidney failure, showed positive responses on eye contact in people with autism. It also alleviated overactivation of the amygdala, which is thought to be a neurobiological feature of autism anxiety. The amygdala is known as the fear center, and it ties emotional values onto different stimuli, making it a key area of interest in autism. In fact, a groundbreaking study of autism brain tissue from people of multiple ages showed that while kids with autism started out with a higher number of neurons in the amygdala, around adolescence, they dropped to lower compared to those that were neurotypical. This suggests that an excess of cells in the amygdala early on caused this region to be too excited and possibly leads to excitotoxicity. This important finding of a developmental shift in the amygdala in adolescence supports the amygdala as a focus for future treatments. In addition, simvastatin, a drug used to treat high cholesterol, also showed positive effects in two different studies of autism. It's not known if simvastatin has any effects on the amygdala, but stay tuned. Not all effective treatments for autism come in the form of a pill or an oil. Behavioral-based interventions that were once only used for preschoolers are now being deployed in classroom settings. Thanks to the patient, supportive researchers who work closely with dedicated, hardworking teachers, the teachers delivered behavioral interventions that resulted in improved outcomes in students. These improvements were not easy. Teachers must be trained and must be willing to incorporate the intervention into the classroom and receive instruction. Tristram Smith, one of the researchers involved in a study of kids in low-resource schools, passed away in 2018. His compassion and dedication to the field is sorely missed. He was crucial to helping show that teachers and interventionists who work together can make a difference for school-age kids with autism. Now, if money and time are no object, there would be more longitudinal studies in autism. Now, longitudinal studies in autism track each person on an individual basis from before they received a diagnosis through adulthood. Longitudinal research is not just about looking at differences between those with autism and those without, but looking at the trajectories of behavior across a few years to a few decades. These studies can describe features of autism or be predictive in helping identify subgroups that respond to treatment or even identify early features that predict later ones. A collaboration between multiple research groups has tracked a group of people with autism from 2 to now 19 and identified common and distinct patterns of behavioral development, illustrating what can happen as children become adults. It shows that overall, there's some improvement in some symptoms of autism, including social communication. However, this improvement was somewhat dependent on language ability. And while this is not always the case, it also shows that there are lifelong opportunities to learn, and improvements can be seen in people with autism across the lifespan. Cognitive abilities in childhood seem to play a big role in cognitive function in adulthood, although many children show academic challenges even with normal to high IQ. Even in younger children, there's great variability in the trajectories of adaptive behavior, which is a measure of functioning in individuals with autism. Some improve over time and some decline. The difference between those that improve or stay stable versus those that decline over time may be crucial to understanding autism. These studies emphasize the importance of early intervention, a tailored individualized approach, and also academic and support across the lifespan. So what does this all mean? There were a number of exciting advances in understanding autism in 2018. Researchers made progress in identifying subgroups, defining biological markers, and developing interventions. There are also studies that demonstrate while autism is a spectrum itself with many different subgroups, it's also part of a bigger spectrum of neurodevelopmental disorders from anxiety to ADHD to OCD. Therefore, these approaches to other conditions may be applicable in autism. In addition, there may be more similarities than differences in the biological features across these conditions. Autism is distinct from other diagnoses, and despite vast differences in symptom presentation, onset, and severity, findings call for improved access to services across all intellectual abilities and through different generations. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoy a wonderful holiday season, and I will talk to you in 2019.